Welcome to the Low Post Podcast, live in studio. We have podcast host and occasional NBA player, Philadelphia 76ers shooting guard JJ Redick. How you doing?
Are we really live? No, we're not live.
I don't know why I said live. We are live and in person, I guess.
Okay. How are you, Zach?
I'm good.
Good.
Restful NBA summer.
It was.
Did you get some rest?
I did. It was a relaxing NBA summer. I was actually out east for like 6 weeks. We did like a month, all of July. Came back to Brooklyn for a few weeks and then went back out for the last 2 weeks of August. So lots of family time.
Is out east the Hamptons? Is that what that means?
Yeah, but I mean, I think when people say out east, it's like the less douchey version of saying I went out to the Hamptons.
I've only been to the Hamptons once for a wedding. I have no idea what's going on in the Hamptons. So
my perception of what the Hamptons are, were, whatever, and what the reality is were two totally different things. Like there's no development. It's like farmland. Beach cottages.
I heard you talking about this.
Wineries. There's all these like cool parks for kids. There's museums for kids. It's just an escape from the city.
You didn't go to any like parties in some plush, huge backyard on the water where everybody had to wear white and drink champagne?
I think I only actually went to one house party, and it was in North Haven, which is a little like sort of islet peninsula north of Sag Harbor. And it was just like at somebody's like modern farmhouse in their backyard and they cooked a whole pig.
Love the whole pig. I'm a big fan of the whole pig party.
But that was, there was no like ritzy, glamorous house parties that I went to. I missed out. David Tepper apparently did invite me to his, so.
Okay. Well, I guess I have the wrong friends. No friends ever invite me. I have one friend who's constantly going to the Hamptons. We're very good friends. And I'm like, you can throw me an invite once. Just tell me where to just try to get me in once.
It's just a really – like it's just a really chill sort of place. And for Chelsea and I, you know, we basically have – we were in L.A. and then Brooklyn, obviously a ton of time in Philly as well. And, you know, we haven't had a backyard and a pool since our kids have been born. And so to be able to like watch them run around and catch fireflies and put their floaties on and swim in the pool.
There you go.
It was fun. It was
fireflies.
A little slice of Americana.
Americana. That's nice. Well, summer's over. You're going to be in China like very soon, to play.
The season got here quick.
Who do you play?
We have media day Friday, the 21st. And then we start training camp.
So that means my favorite part of media day is the photos that you have to take where it's like, okay, JJ, you and Joel, hold this basketball and smile. Like no one holds a basketball like this in regular life, not even basketball players. You guys, JJ, you put your left hand on the ball, Joel put your right hand and smile. It's so dumb.
The thing I don't understand about media day is I understand why you have to do it. Obviously, you talk to the media, take some photos, but the ratio of sort of photos taken versus photos actually used is the disparity is just so great. Like you take 1,000 photos on media day and you might see like your headshot for ESPN and maybe a stock photo they use later in the year.
Your only goal on media day is to not have the John Wall Team USA photo happen to you. There's whatever happened in that photo. You don't want that to happen to you.
Vegas happened,
I guess. But so here's the thing. So I wrote this column that they asked me to write this week.
I wanted to bring this up with you. This hall of absurdities.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whatever.
What do you have some objection?
I don't have an objection because there obviously these things happened.
Yeah.
And it's all truth and it's factual events. But to sort of belittle the NBA into this like circus show, I think is a little disrespectful.
Really?
A little bit.
Wow.
But I know you always, I know kind of you have a very serious writing style. It's very analytical, X's and O's. No, I get it. And then there's the playful side. You always joke about the mascots, you know, 10 things you like and don't like. There's always one sort of playful thing. I don't know, man.
So I think it was, first of all, I've joked about it on the podcast before. And they're like, you just got to write it. And then Hall of Fame week came.
Sure.
And it's in this dead time where like, people aren't ready for serious NBA preview content until like next week. Like I got like seven columns in the works, but like there's like no one's going to read this now. So just do it. So I did it. And we actually had paragraphs in there, like in the J.R. Smith section, which by the way, left out lots of J.R. Smith stuff.
Sure.
I had a paragraph like, in fairness, you know, we could have a sixth man of the year trophy and video of the threes he hit in game seven of the finals. And they're like, you know what? We don't really need this in the, we don't need to be fair. Like, I was like, we could show video of JaVale McGee, like stopping LeBron in the pick and roll in the finals last year and all. Yeah. They're like, yeah, we don't want that. So I'm sorry. You know, ironically, some of the most enthusiastic responses that I got were from inside the league office. So we love this piece. Multiple people emailed me from Olympic Tower saying this
doubt that. The social media buzz around the NBA, I think, has been great for the league. I've talked about it a ton on my podcast.
Yeah.
And it's been great. Like the NBA Twitter sort of subculture it's huge.
I got a toe in. I'm too old to be on NBA Twitter all the time. But so this is how old I am. So I was, in my defense, I was on vacation. So I'm going back through, the DeAndre hostage situation in which you are a participant. And I want to be like, let me make sure everyone.
How did we come? Like, it wasn't a, like, how did we get to
just
the point?
Just let us have fun. No, just let us have fun.
How did we get to the point where it was the DeAndre? Like, I even refer to it as that. And I was there and it wasn't a hostage situation.
Cause it's just funny. It's just, it's like when Chandler Parsons, I had forgotten about this, later said he tweeted the airplane. And he's like, no,
he's on his way to Vegas.
Yeah. Yes. I'm like, I don't care. Yeah. In my head, I'm like Trump when it comes to this. Like that, no, that's fake. I don't care. Like, I'm going to believe what I'm going to believe. And that's it. So I went to Google all the old tweets. I'm like, JJ Redick, car tweet. Like nothing comes. I'm like, what the hell? And then I searched JJ Redick on Twitter. You're gone.
Yeah.
You're out of social media.
Completely.
What happened?
This has been a long time in the making. There's a few different reasons. So I even like – I had a private Instagram account. I deleted that.
That means
well.
It's locked, right, for those of us who are not on Instagram.
What do you mean locked?
Like only certain people
I would have to get
– You would have to approve me.
Follow a request, and then I'd have to approve. Right. But I even deleted that. So like I don't have a social media account in any form or private, public, nothing. I'll say the easiest way to describe it is I have this personality where I'm like all in on something or like I'm off of it.
Okay.
An example would be like watches. So like I got really into watches, reading about watches, collecting watches. It became an obsession and I realized I had to dial it back.
Okay.
So I don't own any watches. I sold all of my watches. I don't own any watches and my life is a lot better because of that. With social media, I always felt like what you're talking about, you have like a toe in, right?
Yeah.
And I've never felt completely comfortable with it. I've never felt completely comfortable sharing. I mean, I think we all do this in a way, but like how many times have you like written out a tweet? You're not on Instagram, but written out a tweet or like, you know, edited a photo, put a caption on it. And then you get to the point you're like, why is this relevant? Why am I sharing this? And so, you know, I think the thing that had been wanting to get off social media, and Tom Haberstroh and I talked about this during the season when I met with him for coffee in Charlotte. I've been wanting to do it for a long time. And then there's the timing, you know, looks suspicious because of, you know, what happened in August, with me and the car service.
I was going to ask you, but there has to be a follow up to this.
But so I it was like the week after that, but this was a conversation that I had started back in June with, someone who works for me and works with me about sort of going to Instagram and Twitter and deleting these accounts. And we actually just finally got it done. It just so happened to be the week after. So like if I was to want to have a public account again on Twitter, Instagram, I would have to restart an entire account and then
get a new, it's gone.
No, it's gone.
Yeah.
I can't like, it's not deactivated. Right. It's out. So
do you feel happier?
Yeah, I do. Social media, I think has its benefits for sure. I also sort of just like, I struggle a little bit, and this is going to sound weird because I have my own podcast. But I struggle a little bit with like sort of the look at me culture that we're in right now. And, you know, like, I think social media has created this platform where everybody sort of makes things about themselves. I'll give you an example. So, like, recently, Manu Ginobili retired.
Yes.
Right? I think an appropriate tweet would be like, Manu, you know, you were an inspiration. You're one of my favorite players ever. Congrats on a great career. However, most people tweeted out something along the lines of, Manu, you're an inspiration. I remember watching you play as a 12-year-old and I worked my butt off and now I'm in the NBA and look at me now. And it's like, whoa. Now you've shifted it and now it's about you. You see this, it's inherent in social media, right? It's inherent. It's all like one big troll. And then Twitter has now become just a bunch of angry voices. And so that for me was like, I had to detach from there. The comment part of Instagram, I had to detach from there. I mean, my son is now like 4 and I'm thinking like, if he goes on, you know, a public account, my public account or my wife's public account and reads comments, like there's some disturbing stuff on there. I'm not comfortable with that. So it was just the time.
It's amazing. Someone tweeted a screenshot and we're also at the point where like, I just assume things are fake now. Like when I see things that are like weird, I'm like, oh, someone made that up.
Right.
So I don't even know if this is real, but someone tweeted, what's her name? Naomi Osaka, who just won the US Open, tweeted an image of the comments underneath her. Like she Instagrammed something with her, the trophy or something. Sure. And some of the comments are like, were mean about like Serena's like, it's all your fault. Serena should have won. How dare you try and steal the spotlight from the winner? Like, these people are either are deranged or
they're bots.
They could be bots. I don't know what the bots do or how sentient they are to do. Or what would happen is, and this happens to you, I'm sure, and to a much lesser extent, me. These people who will say this mean stuff, if they ever saw Naomi Osaka in person, they'd be like, "Oh, hey, you know, congrats on the U.S. Open." And then if she ever discovered, like, "Oh, you're this person who said the mean thing," she'd say, "Oh, you said this mean thing that's really weird." It's like, "Oh, I'm sorry. It's just social media. It's like
So
they would chicken out if you actually confronted one of these people. They would chicken out.
It's not just about that. I think it's just noise. And I think you get to the point in your life where you're like, do I need to filter out some noise?
Yes,
and I just wanted to filter it out. Like there's no reason there was no value added to me from having public or private social media accounts. It was a lot of just wasted time. And then like, so Tom Haberstroh and I got into this whole thing because we were talking about phone addiction.
Yes.
And you know, these phone Apple and these apps and all these things, they've created these products that, you know, there's these dopamine hits that we get. And we are, think about every time you wake up in the middle of the night, 3 a.m. to pee, what do? You reach for your phone.
Because like, I got people on Pacific time. I want to see
like
what they've been up to.
Going on at 3 a.m.
I know.
Just go back to bed.
There's my phone. My phone just went off in the middle of this podcast.
So anyways, I think we're always hopefully trying to like better ourselves, improve ourselves. And so this was just part of it. I think just really like filtering out sort of noise. Finding time, like think about how much time you spend on social media per day, just like reading fluff.
My dead time.
I can find the good stuff. Yeah. I will, if there's good content, I will find it without social media.
See that I've almost forgotten how to do that, like how that process works. Like if there's a good article in the Orlando Sentinel about Jonathan Isaac's offseason, I forgot how I'm going to find that. Other than going to the Orlando Sentinel randomly, like, let's see what they have on the sports page today. Anyway, enough. Is there a follow-up to the car thing?
I'm not at liberty to talk about it.
I had to ask. That's it. Yeah. So what are you, 33?
I just turned 34.
34. Happy birthday.
Thanks, man.
So, are you a Virgo?
I'm a Cancer. End of June.
End of June.
End of June. Okay. Yeah.
I'm a Virgo. Worst sign. Virgo is a terrible sign.
I don't really follow along with all that stuff.
It's just a virginal woman, and I'm a day away from being a lion. It's objectively way better to be a lion.
Wait, when's your birthday?
August 24th.
Okay, so God, that's crazy. You share the same birthday with my 2-year-old Kai.
That's right. I think we've talked about this.
And Stan Van Gundy and Knox have the same birthday. So every year on Knox's birthday, Stan sends me a text: "Happy birthday to Knox."
Wow,
easy to remember.
That's great.
Yeah.
So at 34, are you too far into your NBA career to do the thing where, like, every summer I pick one thing in my game that I'm going to get better at, and that's going to be, like, the thing I bring to the table this year? Are you like, finished product J.J. Redick at this point?
No, I think you can always improve around the edges. Because of my physical sort of limitations, i.e. 6'2.5", 6'3", wingspan on a 6'4", body, you know, there's it's not like I can add something to my game that is going to be like, oh, now he can, you know, play ISO ball and get a shot off against anyone. That's just not going to happen. So, you know, what I've learned about myself is, like, I have three separators, right? So the first separator is skills, right? So I work on my skills, and that's not just shooting, but, you know, being able to shoot off the dribble, ball handling, floaters, runners, all that stuff, like figuring out ways to score. I don't get many just like spot up open looks. I mean, did you read the article? I can't remember who wrote it, about how Steph and Clay got like the most open looks.
Yeah, I did. I saw that. It was Matt Moore.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, it's insane because they play together
and they also have Kevin Durant.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So like you work on your skills, and then the second part of that is like you work on your body. And, you know, that's sort of where you can really make some improvements, I think. You sort of take feedback from trainers. You take feedback from strength coaches. You work with, you know, most guys work with your own trainer. I have my own trainer, John Madonia, here in New York. And we sort of, you know, have this ongoing dialogue about how to improve the body. And that's the improvement. And then the third part for me, I think, is my motor. So that's like the separator for me. And that's just conditioning. Like that's the hard part of the summer that I hate, but you know, I have to like do extra running, outside of just like playing basketball and lifting.
Where do you run? I don't want to like enable stalkers, but do you run outside? Do you run? Do you add things to make your running more difficult? Do you like wear a 20-pound vest? Do you run in sand dunes?
I've done all that stuff. Yeah.
Okay. Seems pretty miserable.
So like when I was out east, I ran at Southampton High School a few days. I did a few days at East Hampton High School. And then I did a day at Pearson, which is in Sag Harbor High School. And then I run on the court, like I'll do sprints on the court. Here in New York, I can't give my location, but it is an outdoor location. So we just like run, but it's not just running. It's, you know, transitioning from like a sprint to a defensive slide to a back pedal.
Sure.
Just that sort of agility work, really working on opening the hips up. In a defensive stance. So like you're constantly working on those
Everyone
things.
Everyone is talking about hips. I just like, yeah. So every year I write this column that's like, my six most intriguing players for the season.
Yeah.
I cheat sometimes, and one of them is going to be, can Domantas Sabonis and Miles Turner play together in Indiana? So I interview both of them. I've never heard, like, my pregnant wife did not talk about her hips as much as Domantas Sabonis and Miles Turner. The whole conversation was about hips, working on hips and band exercise. Hips. Hips are a thing.
They are a thing. John, my trainer here in New York, we started working together at the beginning of last summer. I got connected through him, through Todd Wright, who is the strength coach of the 76ers, and I think one of the greatest strength coaches ever. Todd is amazing. And, you know, the first thing we started working on was joint mobility. So hips, shoulders, wrists, ankles. And, you know, after a year and some change of working on this stuff, like I can honestly say, like, my body feels better than it did 3 or 4 years ago. And I've got a lot more miles on my body than I did 3 or 4 years ago. So that's, I'm glad guys, I actually have talked to a couple guys and I've connected a couple guys with John, because I think, you know, what he's doing is pretty unique for sort of, you know, what NBA players are accustomed to this point. We still lift and do all the normal stuff and functional training and all that. But the joint stuff is huge.
I was reading J. just on the way here some old stories about you, and one of them was an SI story right after you signed originally in Philadelphia the last 2 years ago now, and you were talking in the story about how it had just kind of dawned on you that you just had gone from this veteran team with the Clippers where like children were players children in the locker room, and now like you're going to a team of like literal almost teenagers, and like it was and you were thinking, you said in the story like, I'm good at relating to people, so I'm not worried about it, but it's been a while since I've been surrounded by 22-year-olds. So now a year out, there's people – it's funny how this works in the media. There's already this rush to, like, are Ben and Joel the next Russ and KD, where we're going to, like, monitor these tensions between them and, like, what's the vibe like? And you do hear stories about, like, I've heard Joel is much more of an introvert off the floor than you would ever think based on on the floor, and that the two of them are just sort of, you know, they're not best buddies, they're not yapping, but it's together, but it's something to be sussed out. But you've lived it, so what is the locker room vibe between those two and you relating to them?
Well, as far as the relationship between them, I think it's great. They both are introverts, you know. The media version of Joe and the Joe off the court away from the cameras is two different people. And, you know, Todd Wright told this great story about going back to Africa with Joe and seeing Joe around his family and like playing board games with his cousins and his nephews and all this stuff. And he's like, I just saw like the true Joe. And so that's, I think there's like there's always going to be a bridge between those two guys, and you know, I think they're great at sort of meeting in the middle of that bridge and getting together. Brett does a great job of connecting them, but they're two introverts.
Yeah.
And Ben is like, you know, he's like a family guy. You know, he's with his family, the people, you know, the people that he grew up with, his brother Sean. I've witnessed this now for 13 years. Like, why do players have to be best friends with each other? I don't think it matters.
They don't.
I don't think it matters.
On the court, Ben is such a unique player.
Yeah.
That I do think it's how they share space on the floor is going to be interesting. Because Ben is such an interior bulldozer and Joel is such a post-up threat. Now he can shoot threes, but just sussing out sort of who is where, when is going to be
interesting. Yeah, I think from a beyond the sort of personality, beyond the sort of vying for attention thing that, you know, every NBA player sort of has to go through, you know, there's the sort of on-court and the basketball fit. And you know, I think they both are unique talents in what they do and their skill sets, but Ben specifically, like you really, to me, you have to just surround him with shooting and allow him to just be who he is. And then find that balance of like getting Joe the ball in the post. I think at times last year we were sort of figuring that out on the fly. And then I think by the end of the season we had figured that out. You know, and that's something that going forward, like as the 76ers build this team, like those are the sort of the things they've got to keep in mind. If those, and they should, but you know, those are the two guys you're going to build around. So you put the talent around them that it fits.
Joe's post game is so interesting. And I think it speaks to, maybe it doesn't, I don't know, but there, I mean, I think it's been well publicized and written by many people that like his conditioning is something that has got to get better. But like there were points in that Boston series in the final game. There was a whole stretch where he just rolled over Al Horford like he wasn't even there. And just it was like complete. And then there were times where like Al Horford literally blocked his shot before it got out of his hand. Like I didn't think that it was possible to do that to Joel Embiid. It's an interesting, like I'm curious to see what his offseason was like and how much and how dominant he can be.
Yeah.
Because he does go through stretches where it's like he's like Shaq, where it's like you just can't do anything to him on the block.
It's like he makes a decision and he's like, the other team's not going to score and I'm going to score every time down the floor. And you see stretches of that. So why doesn't he do that all the time? It's probably
hard.
It's hard for anybody.
Yeah.
You know, you can't do that over the course of 30 to 35 minutes in a game. It's really hard. You do have to, I don't care what type of shape you're in. You have to pick and choose your spots. I think conditioning for him, taking care of his body. I mean, that's the whole key to him having sort of a very, very long prime. If he's able to do that, then he's going to go down. I think he'll go down as one of the all-time great players.
Do you have the same reaction I do whenever he falls over, which is like utter panic?
For the first like 3 months of the season, yes. But then I realized Joe sort of milks that. You know what I mean? Like it's not that it's like acting, but there's just like there's some drama involved in it.
Oh, that makes me feel better.
And so I mean, by the end of the season, I'd be like, ah, he's fine. He's fine. I'm not going to worry. But yeah, I mean, like, I remember it was like one of our preseason games and he's like, he had just gotten cleared for 5-on-5 and he like blocks a shot. He sprints down. He catches the ball on the plane. He goes up to the layup and somebody like, you know, takes his body out and he just keels over and falls. And I remember everybody on the bench just being like, is he okay? Is he okay? Is he okay? And there's that fear. And then, you know, he gets up and laughs and he always says to us, like, I'm not as fragile as everybody says I am.
I hope he's not.
He's not.
Well, you mentioned building around those two guys. There's another guy that we haven't mentioned, that is supposed to be one of the guys that you build around. And I was thinking about, I was like, man, so the Clippers era of your life was, I assume, very fulfilling.
Yeah,
and you guys got very far in the playoffs. There was obviously disappointments, but ultimately a very successful team. However, it was just – there was weirdness in the air. And then you switch teams, and it's like, I don't know that you can have a weirder year as an NBA franchise than you guys had last year, albeit a successful one. And weird thing number one is, what in the hell happened to Markelle Fultz? So he's supposed to be the third guy in projecting your team this season. The biggest challenge for both the projection systems and regular doofuses like me is like, we just don't know what in the hell is happening. So have you seen him this summer? Do we have any idea what's going on?
So he's been out in LA. I haven't personally traveled to the West Coast. You know, by all accounts, I think he's doing well, but like, yeah, I mean, he's the biggest question mark. I think he's, you know, because we didn't get LeBron or PG or trade for Kawhi, you know, he's the guy I think that could take our team to the next level.
Which, by the way, everyone's painting that as like the Sixers had this big failure of an offseason because they didn't get those guys. I'm like, well, first of all, PG, as you've said on your podcast, was going back to Oklahoma City. That was done. LeBron, I think, was done.
If we sort of connect the dots here on the LeBron to LA thing, like, and as we have all learned, and I don't know if you know Mav, but I know Mav, like those guys are very smart guys. They calculate everything.
Yeah.
Like this LeBron to LA thing. I mean,
it happened July 1st. Yeah. LeBron's never made a decision on July 1st before.
I think it was years in the making.
And then look, Kawhi, we can argue about, right? Yeah. And the popular argument is, well, they should have put Fultz in the deal.
Right.
There is no evidence that the Spurs wanted Fultz. I've been told that the Spurs never asked for Fultz and actively didn't want Fultz and, in fact, wanted one of the two big guys. And if they want one of the two big guys, you say, no, Kawhi's a free agent. We have no idea. Yeah. So I just don't think it's possible for a team with Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons and cap space going forward to have a failure of an offseason. Like, if that's your standard, like, well, we didn't get one of the three guys who are all top 10 players, well, then, you know, I don't know what you're supposed to do. The Bielitsa thing was weird.
Yeah, but that's sort of a marginal move.
Okay, back to Fultz.
I think, hold on, but I want to talk about this point, too. Because, I, you know, some of this is, I don't want to say that it's by the Sixers' own fault, but I think so much was placed on the summer, right? As they sort of forecasted and projected out going back 2 or 3 years, like this was the summer, you know, we're extending Joe. We're going to have to extend Ben. This was the summer. And then this coming summer is sort of the last summer.
Yeah, you got one more.
One more shot. And, you know, you sort of swing for the fences. And if you look at the list of guys that Philly wants, it was three guys this summer. And then next summer, you know, it's probably three guys. And if that doesn't happen, you know, I don't know what direction they pivot to, but, you know, I think if you're Philly, right, and you're trying to get guys to go there, like what is your pitch to them? Your pitch is you know you're gonna win. You're the last piece.
You're the last piece.
You're the piece that's gonna fit with Joe and Ben, and maybe Markel, and I think the other pitch is Brett. You know, I think Brett has proven to be like a great coach, and players like playing for him. He's a player's coach. Even though he's a little old school, he's a player's coach.
Yeah, does he make you run? You were mentioning running before. I was going to ask, does Brett make you run?
Spencer Hawes texted me the other day because he sent me a photo of him like going to dinner at, I don't know, June Baby or something, some posh restaurant in Seattle. And I was literally at the track that day. And mm-hmm. I was like, I sent him a photo back of me at the track and then my life. And, and he's like, does Brett still, do the conditioning test? And I was like, not that I know of. So I guess maybe, because okay. Spencer's last year in Philly was Brett's first year in Philly.
Yeah.
And that was with like the Thaddeus and Evan Turner, that
tank,
crew.
Tank job number one.
And, yeah, exactly. And, so he must have done a conditioning test in the past. I don't think there's anything like that. I think you just like come into camp in shape, do it on your own.
Speaking of Spencer Hawes, I'm springing this on you, right? It's a very serious question. True or false? Spencer Hawes and you and someone I forget went to the Jiro Dreams of Sushi restaurant, and Spencer Hawes wanted to wear jorts there and had to be talked out of it.
Wait, who told you this story? Did I tell you this story?
No, you didn't tell me the jorts part.
All right. So we were in Tokyo last summer, and I had planned out – I'm kind of OCD about like having a plan. So I planned out all the restaurants and like probably 2-3 months in advance. So Jiro Dreams of Sushi is a documentary on Netflix. You know, we get a lunch reservation at his place. It's like a 3-star, you know, Michelin 3-star restaurant in a subway stop in Tokyo.
Yeah.
So I always sort of plan, like you don't want to be like the underdressed guy, right? So you're somewhere in the middle. I'm not overdressed, but I'm not underdressed. Like,
yeah.
In all occasions. And I figured, like, we're going to a 3-star Michelin restaurant. I'll probably need to have pants on. Like, I'll probably need to wear
jeans.
Pants. Yeah. Just any pants. Yeah. I think I was wearing chinos. I might have been, yeah, like, I don't know. I was wearing pants, though, that covered my lower leg.
Yeah.
Okay?
That's what pants are.
And a collared shirt.
Okay.
Just because I was like, it doesn't say jacket required, but worst case, I got a polo on, chinos, and shoes.
Yeah.
So I'm good.
You're good for a lot of environments.
Right. So it was my brother-in-law, Hattie, and Spencer. It was the three of us on the trip. So they rolled out, and I, at the time, was not thinking clearly. Otherwise, I would have told them to go change. But I remember thinking, like, they're underdressed. Hattie rolls out in, like, shorts, and I think he did have a polo on, but shorts and a polo and flip-flops. And then Spencer, I don't know that he was wearing jorts, but the story gets worse. So that he... So he's also wearing some shorts and a t-shirt, and I don't know what shoes he had on. So we go and we get there and we realize that you need to have pants and a collared shirt. So we also got there like 5 minutes before our reservation. So at this point we're panicking.
Right.
Because it's one of those places like you get seated. It's 20, the whole meal is 20 minutes. It's like a minute per course.
Yeah.
As soon as you get done eating one piece of fish.
And you can't rebook for tomorrow.
Right.
Yeah.
So there was a diesel store next door. So we go to the diesel store, and Hattie and Spencer picked out an outfit. But like Spencer's 7 feet.
I was going to say, I don't know if
so
he ready.
Just, I have a picture somewhere. I'll show it to you later. But he just looked ridiculous. He had a Canadian tuxedo on. He bought like the biggest shirt they had at Diesel, which was a button-up jean shirt, and then he bought the biggest jeans they had, which didn't come down to his ankles, but it was enough to get in the restaurant. Hattie did the same thing.
This is amazing.
We go to the restaurant, eat the meal, have our little cantaloupe dessert or whatever, pay the tab. All 30 minutes. We're in there 30 cool. minutes. It was the most incredible sushi experience I've had, but we're in there 30 minutes. We go back to Diesel, and they return the clothes.
Okay. All right. That was on my list, and you brought up Spencer. Back to Markel Fultz. So you've heard he's looking better. We'll TBD.
TBD.
You were You were very, I think, protective of him last year. There was one time where you were at practice, video surfaced of like, I don't know why we're asking all these questions about him and blah, 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 blah. Was that about us in the media? Was that about just, you know, everyone says the one thing you hear constantly from everybody is he's a wonderful kid. So is that just like sympathy toward him? Do you think it was covered unfairly? What was that about?
So some of it, I think you have a responsibility to cover the news and cover the story.
He's the number one draft pick.
And it was, again, if I'm making a list of the five most sort of surreal, bizarre storylines of my career, like it probably makes the top five. DeAndre hostage situation, also top five. And so, like, I get it. There's attention to it. You know, I think what made me angry that particular day, and this had been sort of festering, was the way in which people were physically covering him with the cell phones. So that was like our third practice leading up to, I think it was the trade deadline, and I think the trade deadline had just passed. So we'd had like three practices in that span of that week. And every time we would finish practice or finish shoot around, and the doors would open for the media, Markel would be on the other end, and you'd see this like mad rush to get like prime footage location. Everybody would get their cell phones out and start recording him. Who the f*** knows? Dribbling a basketball, shooting a free throw, mundane things. We had by that point had seen months of him shooting. Okay. On that particular day was Brian Colangelo had given a press conference, which I knew he was giving the press conference. It was post-trade deadline. And they all came in, and the body language, it was like they were vultures preying over a dying, decaying body. The kid was 19. He's clearly going through something. And I got angry. And I verbalized that anger, and maybe I shouldn't have, but I basically cussed them out.
It was an honest reaction.
Yeah. And, and then I calmed down and they asked me about it and I gave a much better sort of answer. But, you know, I that's my guy. Like Markel's, you know, he was my rookie. I was protective, but I was empathetic because, you know, whatever he was going through physically or mentally, like, as an athlete, we've all sort of been there, and there's varying degrees of extremes to that, but we've been there. And so I was empathetic towards that.
Could you guys talk to him, or was it like he needs space, or it's like it's one of these things where it's like it's best not to talk about the elephant in the room?
I would say just in general. I'm not has nothing to do with Markel. Just in general, when these sort of things happen, right? And I've probably had these sort of things happen to me at different times. Your dad, your mom, your brothers, your sisters, your coaches, your high school coach, your shooting coach, randos on the internet. Everybody's reaching out to try to help you. Everybody wants to be the guy that fixes your problem. And so you inherently have to give your teammate space. Markel and I spent, a few sessions together just chatting, like, I told him right away, like, if you want my help, I will be willing to help, but I am not going to get in the way of whatever you're doing. You know, I'm here. I'm available if you need me. So that was, I felt like as a teammate, that's all we could offer. Yeah. I know for a fact, and again, this is just in general. I know for a fact when these things happen, you've got a horde of people that are both trying to help and are like, being mandated to help, and you have to give your teammate space.
There were also people in your organization who were saying, why is he out there when the media is coming in? Why are we not?
That was his choice. So you have to give him, like, that was his choice. They like, we as an organization could have, like, Markel is an adult and he made that choice. He wanted to be out there. So that's fine.
The other, bizarre storyline, and it's honestly, it's sad. It's not funny.
It's not.
It's sad.
It's not.
But I just, from a player's perspective, you keep going through these things. how do you receive and interpret the Brian Colangelo thing as a player on his team? How did that hit you?
How did it hit me? I think you get, in a way, numb to the absurdities of the NBA. That same day, I had fallen asleep with my son. I put him to bed at 7:45, so I'd fallen asleep with him in his room. And I woke up at 9:10-ish, and I had a text from Tommy Alter from The Ringer. And he's like, "Hey, man, there's a story coming out in 20 minutes about BC. I had no idea. I would have given a heads up earlier. There's only three people in the whole office.
They kept it
under wraps.
They kept it super under wraps."
So I'm like, all right. So, I read the story. And then the next morning, I was telling my wife about just the Ringer story, just that side of it, not necessarily any reaction. Here's sort of what has happened so far. This is before the Twitter sleuths got on it and started connecting some dots. And she was like, "Oh, TMZ just came out and said Ben and Kendall are together." My joke to her was I thought this is Clippers 2.0. What's happening right now?
Okay.
So you do become a little numb to it. I think mostly I felt bad for BC. And I'm not going to speculate on who was behind what account or anything like that. I would just say I feel bad for him because I feel like he is a professional. He has been a professional.
This is his life.
This is his life. This is his pride. This is what he loves to do. So I feel bad for him. I spoke with him after. I know you spent some time with him as well. And I can't imagine what he's going through. I just, I feel bad for him.
I think that should be everybody's prevailing reaction. It's a really crappy situation. I just am curious from a player's perspective, and this is what the owners had to grapple with in the aftermath of it. And by the way, it's a situation for them too. They Brian. They don't know. Yeah. It was a hard thing to suss out. But I think so some of the tweets have this stuff about trade rumors and medical information. And there was all this, are the players going to be able to trust BC? Will a free agent from another team look at this and say, I don't know if I can trust? Did that resonate with you at all? Or are you just this is a crazy situation?
I think my feeling on that was, if there's any chance that is an issue, then you have to sort of go down the road. That's just reality. If there's a chance that a free agent won't come because of
did you ever think, boy, I wonder what he knows about me. I hope there's no tweets. Not that there's anything controversial about you, but did you ever think this is a betrayal of my trust as a player?
I have to be honest. For me, BC, he brought me in. He was the GM that met with me along with Josh and Blitz and with Brett and everybody last summer. He was the guy that spearheaded the conversation with my agent at the time. So there was that sense of loyalty. And then from what happened in February, BC was so good to me then. And so I felt a sense of loyalty, and I still feel that sense of loyalty to BC.
We'll see what happens, going forward. It's a sad situation. Do you shoot four-pointers in practice?
You guys
have the four-point line, right?
Oh.
Aren't you one of the teams that has the four-point
line? Yeah. It's not to shoot behind.
Okay.
It's to space behind and then step into your shot.
I think more teams are going to have that.
It makes sense.
This year.
We've now color-coded the corners, too.
Really?
Yeah. As our sort of secondary offense, not necessarily fast break 3-on-1, but as off a miss, we're pushing, our job, if you're not Ben, is to get to the corners. First guy down, you get to the corners, you sprint to the corners. And analytically, of course, the corner three is the most valuable three. So they've always placed an emphasis on that. Now they've color coded it. And so we've got that plus our 4-point line, whatever you want to call it. But that's more of a spacing thing. So I did this naturally in LA during a Blake CP pick and roll. I would space, I sometimes go out damn near half court sometimes. If my guy's going to go with me, then I've sort of done my job.
Yeah.
And obviously
I think you've written about Houston or shown clips of Houston, but like the way Ryan spaced for them and the way Eric spaces for them.
I think that's going to be a thing this year.
Yeah.
I think more players are going to do that. Anthony Tolliver even told me like that's what he's working on for the summer. Like I want to shoot 28 footers. I just think it's going to be, we're going to see more of that. I don't know.
But you have to, for it to be effective, you have to, not everybody can shoot 28 footers and not everybody's a good enough shooter where if I go out to the hash mark, someone's going to still gravitate towards me.
Yeah.
Right? If a non-shooter goes out to the hash mark, it doesn't really do anything.
Yeah.
You're actually it's probably better for the defense.
Yeah. Shot clock also matters, right? If there's like five on the shot clock, just throw it up instead of.
You think about like what I think about this a lot in the last like year about how timing matters so much. Like as a player, obviously the greats are the greats, but I think about that stretch like post Jordan. When all those guys, all those like 6'8", sort of 6'9" guys were getting drafted, like Quintel Woods. Remember that whole, like DeMar Johnson, like that whole group of guys from like 2000 to 2004 that were like sort of tweeners.
Yeah.
They didn't have any really like definitive skill set. And it was like, they were like almost before their time.
Yeah.
And now you look and everybody's like, well, we want 6'8" wings that can sort of guard multiple positions. That's all anybody wants anymore. That's just interesting to me. I think about that.
Yeah, we talked about
what are this. The skills? I mean, shooting is the one obvious skill set that sort of translates between eras.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to be able to shoot. You have to have spacing and shooters.
Yeah, it's funny. People talk about there is this evolution, but, you know, the last 3 or 4 years, we've heard coaches talk about, you know, the way the game has changed with spacing and how defenses play it is like, you know, we need everyone's got to be smart.
Yeah.
Everyone's got to, like, when you catch the ball, you got to be able to make a quick play, pump and go. And I'm like, yeah, but that's not new. Like, it was always good to have smart players. Like, it's, I guess smarts can mean different things in different eras depending on the style of the game. But that's what you hear. That's what you've heard coaches saying. Like, we need quick decision makers, guys who know where the next play is, you know, who can leverage their shooting into making a play for somebody else.
Sure. Sure. That's what we had in Orlando. That's what Stan preached. And that was 9-10 years ago. If Jahlil Okafor, I love Ja, by the way. If Jahlil Okafor played in the '90s, what would his career look like?
He could play now.
I agree.
He just needs
I'm just
to
saying,
get better
like,
at some stuff.
There's a negative connotation on him now because of the last 2 or 3 seasons when clearly the guy can get buckets.
Get buckets, but if he gives all the buckets back, it doesn't really matter. But the interesting thing about him was like the defense is what it is. Like he's just got to get better. He was a good passer at Duke, and like he just didn't pass in the NBA. That was the weird thing. It's almost like he came in and was like, I got to get numbers. Like I got to put up points. So he was like a decent passer at Duke, and it didn't translate.
Have you seen his body, by the way?
I've seen the Instagram
holy
stuff. Yeah,
he got shredded, man.
That's good.
I'm happy for him.
Are you gluten free? Did you ever go gluten free? No, you can't. Okay.
No.
I met with a coach who shall remain nameless last week or a couple weeks ago who's gluten free now and is contemplating like there's like a super gluten free that has a name I've never described before where it's like even I don't really even know the technicalities. It just seems like
there's all this new stuff like the keto.
Maybe that's what it is.
Keto,
that sounds familiar. Is that
like,
super gluten free?
Well, it's like keto is like something about where you time, I think
you eat only dirt and shrubs.
No, but you time your meals and you eat only certain things and your body gets in this state of sort of like maximum sort of energy, productivity, whatever. I don't know enough about it. That's in 5 minutes of reading about it. But there's a new diet every other 2 months.
One of my favorites.
I believe in moderation. I will say this though, the older I get and the more I read and the sort of the more I am in tune with my body, like I'm sort of leaning towards going to some sort of version of a plant-based, maybe fish, maybe pescatarian diet. I had dinner with Mike Dunleavy last night. We ate at like a steakhouse, smokehouse, this new place that opened in Tribeca.
Oof.
It was just like, it was just meat.
Just
you know?
Those two words next to each other, I just like started sweating.
It was awesome. Yeah. It was good. But like,
I didn't know he was here, by the way. Someone last week told me he's here.
Yeah, he lives. He lives downtown.
I've heard
downtown
he's quite Manhattan. Sharp about the NBA, and can have a career in the league if he wants to.
I think you'll be hearing some stuff soon. But,
yeah.
He's him and I. So when I was in high school, I used to go like down to Duke and play pickup on the weekends, or you know,
in Roanoke, right?
Yeah, so, and it was like 2.5 hour drive. Yeah. But I would just like I'd hang out with Mike, and we never played together until Milwaukee. But that's my guy.
I read that you you decided when Leitner hit the shot in 92, you told your parents, "I'm going to Duke." That's it.
I think that's a thing.
You said it. You said it in a profile. So, but memory is a funny thing.
I do remember watching that game. So I remember watching that game.
So I was must have been like 8 or something.
I was getting ready to turn 8. Yeah. So I was. It was April. I'm a June birthday. So it was end of March, whenever it was. And so I remember that game. I remember specifically watching that shot. And I remember the Duke Michigan game, the championship game that year, because I watched it like 25 times.
God, I wanted the Fab Five to win. Sorry. I love the Fab. Look, I was a teenager. The Fab Five was the coolest thing in the world.
Okay. I don't.
Bobby I'm Hurley not, I wasn't don't just, cool.
Yeah.
But then you read about Bobby Hurley and you read about Christian Laettner and you read about what they were really like. And it's like, oh, yeah, they were actually kind of cool. But dumb teenager who doesn't read profiles of Christian Laettner and profiles of Bobby Hurley, like you just thought they were not cool. Those guys were tough and cool. Like Christian Leitner's background, that dude's a bad. He's not some pretty boy dude. Yeah. He was a bad.
Yeah, he was a bad. But yeah, I wanted to go to Duke my whole life. I mean, that was my earliest sports memories were Duke basketball and the Atlanta Braves. Those are my earliest sports memories.
I hated the Braves too. Not two. I didn't hate Duke. I don't know why I said two. I was a Mets fan growing up, so the Braves were like, you know, I just couldn't stand the Braves.
I don't think there's anything wrong with like rooting for winners, you know?
No.
As a Mets fan. Are you still a Mets fan?
No, I have my baseball fandom has a whole sordid history. But the Mets are I never cared about a team as deeply as I cared about the Mets from like 1984 till 2002. And then for various reasons, my baseball fandom went on.
Wait, how old were you in 1984?
7.
Okay. All right.
That's when I picked the baseball team. I went to a Mets Pirates game because my mother is from Pittsburgh. And I said, whoever wins this game is going to win my fandom. And that's how I became a Mets fan. I was prohibited from liking the Yankees because my father is a Red Sox fan. He said, you have to pick.
Different team.
He discouraged me from picking the Red Sox because I wanted to be the fan of my dad's team. And he just said, this is just going to ruin your life if you pick the Red Sox. So pick a
little different.
Little did he know.
Yeah.
I only bring up that game because I will argue until I see something better. That Duke-Kentucky game is the single greatest game of any sport that I've ever seen. It's the best game I've ever seen. Because it was just back and forth.
It was like 94, 92, 95, 94, 96. Yeah. I mean, just the last 10 minutes of that game and overtime were ridiculous.
How close did you actually get to signing with the Pacers?
Very. Yeah.
I mean,
very. So basically.
That's a fun team. I don't.
Basically, I had conversations with a few teams. You know, July 1 at midnight. Phoenix was the one team that said, like, we can make something happen straight away.
Oh, interesting. I hadn't heard that one before.
And then
that's the Ariza slot, I guess, probably.
No, it was after that. It would have been through a trade, obviously. Okay. But then, like, so, you know, the Indy thing came up basically July 1 during the day. I talked to Nate for, like, 20 minutes one night and – you know, we were sort of waiting on LeBron, and then once LeBron made his decision, then it was like the Lakers were sort of involved as well. There was an opportunity there.
Boy, that would have been fun.
Yeah, it would have been. And then, but I did know ahead of time, like, this is what the market's going to be this summer.
Sure.
There was a couple 2 and 3 year deals for less that I could have pursued. But it was not sort of situations that I thought were great situations. The Indy situation was really intriguing to me. I wouldn't have started, but you know, I felt like, you know, I sort of fit what they needed, and I just envisioned playing like two man with Sabonis and getting dribble handoffs from him on that left side. And
he's good.
Sabonis he's really good. And then it was like basically deadline time. You know, it was, you know, you've got basically I think 3 or 4 hours left, and I was in the pool, and my agent called and said, all right, well, you know, Philly changed their offer, and it, you know, initially it was just it, like, I'm 34. There's too much money like to sort of give up. I will say that like Indy's offer was more than Philly's offer. Still, yeah. I took, you know, not a lot, but I took less to go to Philly.
Would you, I mean, you've talked about the, how you have a place here now and the proximity of Philly. Yeah. Would you have left your family here?
Yeah. So like I told, so like that's the, that was the hard thing, I think, too. It's like in the weeks leading up to free agency, as like I'm having discussions with my agent, and I'm with CA now, Steve Heumann, and you know, it, like I had to keep telling him, like, listen, because I have friends in the NBA, you know, where I talk to everybody, sure. And like I'm like, this needs to be said to everybody, like, this is my career, like my family is certainly important to me, but like my wife would be fine if I had to go play somewhere else. She's going to be fine. My kids are going to be fine. I have plenty of time to be a dad. Is it ideal? No. But my family's going to be here. I have no problem for however much longer I play, playing anywhere.
Interesting.
If it's the right fit. You know, the Philly thing, even last summer, that was not a proximity play
right.
by any stretch. Sure, the one-year deal was great. I did not want a one-year deal under any circumstances. For me, the Philly play was, I thought it was the best fit on the court. And
turned out to be a great fit.
Turned out to be a great fit on the court, and we won a lot of games. So I think going forward, like, that's the sort of things that you sort of have to, you know, think about in your mind. But I'll play anywhere. I've said this publicly. I'd like it to be in Philly. Like, Philly, yeah. Philly's been great. It's been a great experience so far. I'm hoping this year is even better than last year. But I'll play anywhere.
It's going to be an interesting year for you guys in Philly. A lot of optimism. I can't wait to see how the team looks. You've got to go somewhere. And
to the gym.
To the gym. You got to go run.
To the gym. And then, well, the gym first, and then I'm going to go to my undisclosed location to do some sprints.
I'm going to go watch film of Jamal Murray. That's what I got going on. JJ, thank you. Congrats on another great season, another great free agency deal. We look forward to your podcast and also seeing you play NBA basketball on a good team in the Eastern Conference.
Thanks, Zach.
Thanks, bud.
All right.
The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Drive always discovers possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.